Welcome, everybody, to episode 8 of Hold That Thought with Jarrett Simpson. Jarrett graduated from WMU Cooley Law School cum laude with a concentration in intellectual property law. He has represented musicians and artists in contract and trademark disputes and assisted with copyrights and licensing clearances. Also a musician and songwriter in the bands Between Bluffs and OK. In this episode, we discuss plagiarism versus influence, copyright and copyleft, originality in the eyes of the Supreme Court, intellectual property, contracts, shady booking agents, integration clauses, and setting standards for musicians. This episode was an absolute blast to record, and I'm really looking forward to having Jarrett come back and share some more knowledge about the law side of the music industry. I hope everyone enjoys episode 8 of Hold That Thought with Jarrett Simpson. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Hold That Thought. My name is John Samuel, and I'm going to be your host. I'm joined in the studio today with my good friend and mentor, Jarrett Simpson. Welcome, Jarrett.
Thanks for having me, John.
Not a problem. Well, I'm so glad to have you on because I have lots of questions to ask you about the law side, and you've been kind of coaching me for the last 7 years, believe it or not.
Wow, yeah, it's been a while. I don't know if I'd call it coaching, but we've definitely talked our way through some situations over the years.
Yeah, no, we definitely have. We've probably gone through a handful of different contracts, and I think that just goes with each venue or each gig. I know I've had you revise many for me, and you've always been there. So one of the things, one of the questions I've crafted was about plagiarism. From the Beach Boys to the Beatles, swiping melodies and lyrics in the music industry is a lot more normal than we think. The classic rock band Led Zeppelin has been cited with 10 ripoffs, and these songs include Baby, I'm Gonna Love You, Dazed and Confused, Whole Lot of Love, The Lemon Song, Bring It On Home, Since I've Been Loving You, Breuer Stomp, Hats Off Roy Harper, In My Time of Dying, and Boogie with Stu. It seems that Led Zeppelin lived by the motto, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than give permission. I know rhythm, chorus, and lyrics are covered, but are actual beats covered as publishing and copyright law?
Well, I guess you know, it sucks when you're a lawyer and you have to answer the question as maybe, but that tends to be the answer a lot of times when you get a question like that, because it's hard to say. Under copyright law, there just has to be some originality to what you create in order for it to be subject to protection. So, and the Supreme Court has given the definition of original very broad implications. So, you know, the case that went up to the Supreme Court to decide that question was about phone books, and a totally different context, right? But copyright applies to the phone book the same way that it would apply to the lyrics of a song. The law doesn't really distinguish between those two things. It's, you know, how you assemble words on paper. We've got a lot of different words to describe what that is, but the law kind of keeps it general. And what happened in the case is basically there was one phone book company that was only publishing numbers in a single county, and another phone book company came along and they took all the information out of their phone book and they combined it with five other counties in the area.
Wow.
And they made a super regional phone book that basically put all the other phone book companies out of business.
Which if you really think about probably happens in a lot of fields. Like, for example, writers call it swipe files. They create swipe files, and anytime they hear a quote or read something out of a book, they pull that and they put it into their swipe file.
Right.
So it probably happens more than just like the telephone book industry.
You know, just to finish that thought, the Supreme Court, when they looked at it, they said, you know, this wasn't really, the phone book is really not an original idea. And copyright requires some kind of originality. And putting a bunch of people's names in a phone book in alphabetical order with their phone number, there's nothing original about that. It's methodical. If they had taken the names and they had done something a little bit more like Angie's List or something, where they
categorize
them, profession, or they you know, put some sort of editorial in there about businesses or names or whatever, then that would have been original enough to be protected under copyright. But the fact that you put names in alphabetical order is not original, and so they said it wasn't subject to copyright. So take that case and apply it to a beat. You know, if it's not, maybe it's just a 4-bar beat where it's, you know, bass on the one, snare on the three, whatever, you know, then maybe that's not original enough to be protected under copyright. But that question gets really difficult for courts to handle too, because you know, there's another case when this comes up all the time with sampling, right? Because, you know, rappers will take, sometimes they'll take just a single chord from a guitar strum and then they'll reverse it and drop the pitch of it or something like that, change it, make it a little bit different. Well, there's a case out there that went all the way up to a pretty high appeals court just under the Supreme Court. So it's pretty influential as far as the law is concerned, where they took a single chord and they dropped it and they changed the pitch, but the court said that they still had copyright protection over that single chord.
Wow.
Even because it met that minimum threshold of originality that was described in the phone book case. So that's, you know, a long description of whether, you know, I don't know what the answer is, if your beat is original enough, because there's different extremes, right?
Gotcha. Well, the reason I asked is because we work with a wide variety of musicians, and when I was doing my research for this podcast, that was one of the things that repeatedly came up through music articles online. So I was pulling up a wide variety, like I read the Beach Boys and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Zeppelin, and it seems like there's a lot of artists who have been charged.
Yeah, you know, Miles Davis is famous for saying, good musicians borrow, great musicians steal, you know, and I think
that's a great quote.
The wisdom behind that is that if you borrow something, it still belongs to the other person.
Yeah.
But when you steal it, it becomes yours and you own it at that point. And so that's kind of as far as, like, you know, Zeppelin and Johnny Cash, and even like back in the day before modern copyright law, it was a lot more common for musicians to borrow. And it was just what you did. It was, in fact, you know, it wasn't until like the Beatles came along that songwriting and being original for yourself, doing your own thing, was what you were supposed to do. Before, what you were supposed to do is do what was hot, you know, what everybody else was doing. You know?
Well, it's funny because when I was reading Led Zeppelin, two of the songs, and I can't remember off the top of my head the songs that they were, but two of the songs that they had ripped off were actual bands that they had toured the country with.
Oh.
So the band had opened up for Led Zeppelin, and over the years, Zeppelin just wind up taking right. that rip, that song, and then creating their own song with it.
Right.
So that was interesting.
Well, you know, Led Zeppelin has been, you know, to follow that model, you know, as a lawyer, I could never advise a musician to follow that model, because Led Zeppelin has, of all the bands, when it comes to copyright litigation, which is what you're talking about, all those songs you listed are examples of how, when Led Zeppelin has been sued by people. And
all of them, they have been sued on every single one of them, and they've lost the majority of the cases.
Right.
Most of them, some of them were just settled out of court, and Zeppelin just paid.
Right.
Which makes sense, because Zeppelin has not, if you read back through some articles, they blatantly say that they sampled the song.
Right.
And I think they might have been, and I'm not sure what the timeline is here, but was Zeppelin borderline with what you were just talking about, as far as that it used to be the norm and used to be accepted? Were they on that?
Yeah, I mean, you'd probably be better off, you know, putting that question to a qualified music historian or something. But I, you know, I mean, from what I observed and
well, when did the
Copyright Act came around in 1976.
Okay.
The one that we're operating under today. I mean, copyright as a concept goes all the way back to the founding of the country. It's actually in the Constitution. The copyright clause is part of the Constitution. And so there's been copyrights from day one, but when it was originally applied, it was mostly dealing with science and discovery, things like that, what we would refer to today as a patent. But it wasn't until Stephen Foster, who is a famous old-time songwriter, he wrote the Suwannee River, the Florida State Song or whatever, among other things. He actually was one of the first people to actually make a living as a professional songwriter. And what he would do is he'd write these songs and publish the music. And everybody had a piano in their home back then. You know, you didn't have radio. So they would buy sheet music, and whoever in the family was the piano player, you know, they would buy whatever was the hot song of the time. Stephen Foster was really popular. People would buy his music, the sheet music, and then they would play it around the family piano.
Huh.
But he actually died penniless, because at the time there was, what would happen is he would put out a song and it would be hugely popular because he was a pop star of his time. And other publishers, printing companies would get a hold of it and they would just copy it and sell it and pay him nothing.
Wow.
And he really had no recourse back then. And so that kind of brought the issue to the forefront, and Congress made some moves, and you start to get the original copyright acts that cover songwriting and art in the arts. And as technology grew and the arts became a more influential industry, you started getting powerful lobbies like Hollywood and Disney, and now they're coming to Congress with lobbyists and money, and the copyright protections start to become a lot stronger. And so in 1976, we passed what we're operating under now, and it's a very artist creator friendly statute. And so there's a question that I get a lot is people want to know, do they have to do something formal, like register their copyright before they can have protection over it? And the answer to that is no. The way the Copyright Act is worded is that whenever you fix something into a tangible medium, you have copyright over it, as long, assuming that it's original enough and you're the first person to come up with it, right? So like this podcast that you're recording right now on your computer, that audio file that you're saving, you own the copyright to that now. You know, you're my voice and my words and my things, you know, I mean, maybe it can get a little bit complicated on this.
Oh, I'm sure. But if you're... Don't worry, because I think I only have 3 fans right now.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to sue you over it anyway. So that's like the next step for anyone who's thinking about their intellectual property, like their copyright or their trademark or whatever, is what kind of philosophy that do you have over intellectual property and those kinds of assets. And, you know, so there's a movement right now that I kind of subscribe to for my own music and my own creative outlets or whatever, is what they call copyleft as opposed to copyright, you know. And copyleft is more of this open kind of idea that when you create something, you want to share it with people. You want people to play your songs and change them, be inspired by them to create new things. And you want your creation to inspire more creation. And it's a different kind of philosophy than copyright, where what's yours is yours, and you want to own it, and you want to protect it, and you want to prevent others from exploiting it and getting rich off of it.
How big is that? I've honestly never heard of copyleft. How big is that community right now?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, there's an organization called Creative Commons that you've probably seen.
Yeah, I've seen that
on the internet, because they do a lot of work with helping people share content legally and on the internet, and sort of giving what's attribution, you know, because most people, like for me, I don't really ever expect to make a fortune off of my music, but I would like to get credit for what I've done, right?
Yeah.
You know, like if it's my song and I wrote that and it's a piece of me and you know, my personal creative expression, then I'd like to, you know, get the credit for it, for whatever reason. I'm not really sure. Maybe my ego.
Well, I do like the philosophy behind copyleft, because I really think that times have changed and it's different now. People don't want to pay for stuff. So with the philosophy behind copyleft, just, hey, this is a community where we just want to get our music heard.
Right.
And I think by holding back, like famous artists who hold back from putting their music on Spotify or putting it on YouTube,
right,
I really don't see the mentality behind it, because we are almost now in a, when it comes to e-commerce, when it comes to movies and music and CDs and podcasts, I don't really think there's not too many people who actually want to pay. They much rather pay a monthly service,
right,
and get a ginormous catalog of music or movies, or they're just going to buy a 99-cent song.
Right.
So I don't see why people. I do like the philosophy behind copyleft. Just let's get it out there. Let's get our music heard. Let's get our art seen, because I still think there's ways to monetize it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you have to kind of consider the different positions that you might be in. I mean, if you're in the position where your music has already reached a very large audience and it has a value, a fiscal, you know, monetary value that you can kind of pinpoint, because there's certain, you've already hit a threshold of sales, and you know, I wouldn't suggest that if you were in that position that you should just throw it away and not use it to your benefit to negotiate a better deal for yourself and your family and your, you know, what you're trying to do. So I understand where people are coming from when they say, you know, Tool is one of my favorite bands, right? And you can't listen to Tool on Apple Music or iTunes, right? And, you know, which is fine with me, because I already own all their CDs, and you know, it's not really a problem. I disagree with Maynard on his business decision, but I'm sure that he, you know, is doing it for reasons that he feels are just as far as his philosophy is concerned.
But that is the joy to me. That is the joy of the new music business model. So back in the day, if you did not sign with a major record label, your music wasn't getting heard. You had no chance. The AR people were going to get your music on the radio, and it was the only that was the only format. Was the radio one of the only formats? Was the the radio to get your? Of course, people pay live shows, but it wasn't. I mean, it was a tough industry to break in. At least now, if you say, hey, you know what? I don't like iTunes. I don't like Apple or whatever bleep maybe. You still got Spotify. You still got YouTube. You still got a ton of other sources.
You can distribute your music worldwide, and you don't need to land a major record label deal to do it. But there are still gatekeepers in the modern industry. Just as there always has been for as long as there's
been. Yeah, and I don't think that will go anywhere. But
once you there have a certain amount of connections and resources to promote a band or a piece of music, and you can send people across the country and book tours and whatever, you know, obviously those bands are going to have access to more people, and they're going to make it to a different level than the guys who are just playing around locally in the bars and the restaurants. And even though you can put your music on an online platform and theoretically people in Japan can listen to it, but are they ever going to hear about it, or are they ever going to be able to search the right key terms on Google so that they miraculously land on your page?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, so I think that people get a little bit excited about the possibilities and sort of ignore the realities in some sense of that, you know. So, but I think, you know, just getting back to copyleft, I think it's a good philosophy for somebody who is not on that in the big leagues, to put it that way, because, you know, share and share alike is the kind of philosophy that created all the great music that we love, you know, rock and roll and jazz and blues and hip hop. You know, it's all about stealing from each other.
Yeah.
And that's really, you know, creativity is all about inspiring other people.
And that's what really leads me to my next question, because I was kind of pondering this when I was reading about all these different bands and stuff. Where do you think the line should be drawn between plagiarism and influence? So there's a lot of bands that you and I could go out to the Dunedin Brewery and we could sit back and we could watch a fusion band. And you and I could sit back and go, God, man, they sound just like Snarky Puppy. Like, you know, everything about them has that style, has that sound.
It's so subjective, though.
So,
you know, I don't think you could draw a line because
what if you're just influenced?
Yeah.
But it does sound a little too close.
Right. You know, there's this weird kind of dynamic for most musicians about, you know, when you should look inward and when you should look outward and when you should do something for yourself or write for yourself or play for yourself, and when you should play for your audience and you know, write for your audience. There's kind of one side of the philosophy that's kind of like, you know, you should never placate people or play things just to please your audience. You know, you should always do something that you feel creative and you know, inspires you. But then, you know, there's the other side.
That's how
it's like, you know, I like to be part of something bigger. And if, you know, I want to inspire people, then I want to do something that people can relate to. And
do you struggle with that as a musician?
Absolutely. Yeah, all the time. I mean, you know, that's like I said, it's one of the, you know, great debates for most musicians that really put a little extra thought in what they're trying to accomplish when they write or play, or what's the whole purpose behind all this stuff, you know. But, you know, as far as plagiarizing, you know, as a legal question, I think what we talked about before, it's not very hard to get to that threshold.
Gotcha.
Of you've just illegally infringed upon someone's copyright.
That's my song now, there, buddy.
Whether or not that's the, yeah, whether or not that's how, you know, music actually works, I guess it really depends on what kind of expert you could hire to testify for you on your behalf in court, you know? So that's kind of...
Well, that's cool. You know, that, it's a really intriguing subject, and I had a fun time researching the different bands. And I'm a Led Zeppelin fan, so I kind of stayed on some Led Zeppelin articles. We're moving right along, and these are questions that have been stemmed from my actual booking agency,
right?
And not fans of Hold That Thought, but they actually have come up in everyday discussions, and I wanted to see if you could help elaborate on some of them. That way we can help strengthen the community with their knowledge on the business side. Because I always see that's one thing that artists need help with is not that they don't know the business side. It's that they tend not to think about the business side of the music business because their creative brain takes over. Which is... Right. Completely understandable, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, not to get philosophical about every question that you ask, because that's what I'm about to do again, but I think it kind of goes back to what are your goals? What is the reason that you're doing this? Like, what drives you when it comes to playing music? Do you want to get to that level of touring and you know, major record label deals, and do you want to write songs that get played on the radio and that you make lots of money from, or do you want to just express yourself and maybe play a gig at the bar on a Saturday night, you know?
That's the thing. The biggest thing I see with artists is where they struggle is actually defining their goal.
Right.
But not only just defining their goals as a musician, but holding themselves accountable for their goals. So there needs to be some type of like weekly or biweekly accountability where if you really want to make it in the music business, then you can measure your goals, and you can measure what steps you're taking and make it. And it's similar to me. For years, I talked about doing a podcast and keeping up with my blog and putting this series together with Dummy M&F, and I just procrastinated.
Right.
And procrastinated. Yeah. And I understand how people get stuck in that cycle, but I never measured my goals until recently. So that's one thing I've been doing is I sit back and I say, okay, and even if, you know, if you want nothing to, not to measure your music career, but even something simple as a workout, at the end of the week, figure a way to measure your workout so you can actually see if you're improving or if you're just going through the motions. Because if you're just going through the motions, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know,
I don't know. I mean, I think for musicians, I think some of it's kind of just compulsive and habitual. So I maybe that's kind of, that would be kind of sad for in my opinion, if I were to just if it became a habit instead of something that inspired me. But I think it's perfectly okay for, you know, to each their own. But.
Oh, no, definitely.
What I want to say, though, about the professionalism versus the artistry. What a lot of musicians are up against is not just the creative brain taking over and sort of, you know, forget that this is a business and don't look at what they're doing as a service or a commodity or whatever, but it's art and get really protective of it, you know. But the industry itself is a very informal industry, and the buyers, the talent buyers, the venues, the patrons, the people that are paying for the service of music, they're not helping either. I don't know if they almost have a vested interest in keeping it informal, because that makes it easier
there's no such thing as consistency with it.
Right.
Where, I mean, if you open a hot dog stand and you're selling something tangible and you're selling it every single day,
right,
and people are perching that.
And there's a cost to it that you could say, well, I paid, you know, X for the hot dogs and Y for the buns.
You could pull your P&L statements up,
right,
and you can look at that. Whereas if I measure, if I book between bluffs somewhere and 300 people show up at the brewery to see them, I can measure that. But then we go to the next show and say I put you at Miyaka State Park and 10 people show up.
Yeah.
And so there's nothing consistent about it. You can't measure it.
Right.
So I think that's
where you're kind of stuck on standard rates because we all know the different. Any musician who's booked a gig knows the different ways that you get paid. You know, you either get paid by the door, you get paid in ticket sales, or you're going to get a flat fee from bar sales because they're not going to charge anybody to come and see you. And, you know, when it comes to ticket sales, that's when you're in a whole different ball game because you're going to have some numbers to show.
And you got to hustle.
Right.
You got to promote the hell out of that show, and you got to market the show, and you got to hustle.
Yeah. Well, there's a certain level where other people are doing that hustle for you, you know, right?
Like
when you're on the level of selling tickets, it really doesn't make sense for a band that can't hire someone else to do the hustle for them to sell tickets, because you're not going to make any money, because there's no way that you can do the promotion and write the songs and play the and do all the other
well
stuff,
small so. You know what I like about small bands and like just up and coming bands who are playing those small venues, like the Market on 8th is the Market on 7th. But what I like about artists who play those venues is that they're forced to be creative. So their visual posters are creative. I've seen bands in small towns rent a ad before the movie theater starts, and they put a nice poster visual, and it says, hey, this Friday, you know, for a whole month, Friday, April 18th, we're playing we're playing down here at the park, and the manager would cut them a deal because it's just an old small
band,
theater. I was walking with my daughter right before Thanksgiving, and we're at the Causeway, and I saw Sidewalk Chalk for the Swanee Music Festival.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's awesome.
Well, you got to think outside the box. You know, part of the problem
with
the internet is that people have gotten away from that other type of, that the old school way of putting a poster on every PowerPoint.
It's memes. What I see, it's just straight memes. Like, here's the thing I see all the time is, hey, we're playing 7 to 10, come catch us. We're going to be rocking Friday night, 8 to 12.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it's the same thing.
To go back to the pay model, there's really not a whole lot of incentive for a musician, artist, who's playing the 7 to 11 cover, top 40 covers at the bar to get out there and do the guerrilla marketing and that, because they're going to get their payment regardless. And this kind of goes back to contracts, which I'm sure you wanted to talk about at some point. And that's kind of, you know, as far as the professionalism level of the industry is very low, because the contracts they basically consist of a text message from the bar manager saying 7 to 11, March 31st, $400, you know, period.
Yeah.
And that is a contract. That is a legally enforceable binding contract that if somebody breached, we could go to small claims court to to settle, right? But people don't look at it that way. They don't think of it that way. They think contract, that's got to be some, you know, some lawyer from Mount Vernon has to come down and say, hear ye, whereto, as our appurtenances are declared, or some crap like that, you know. But it doesn't...
So can that be reversed?
What do you mean?
So the band completely blows off the gig.
Well, then the band's in breach, and so I guess the question is the what is the damage to the bar for? So if the contract is a text message, like I just said, 7/11, March 31st, $400. You text that to me, and March 31st comes around, and I'm drunk off my butt and don't show up, you know, and you end up having to scramble to find another musician. Maybe you. Half your restaurant left at 8 o'clock when they normally stay till 10. You know, these are you know what you would call consequential damages to my breach. And so theoretically, this never happens, by the way, but as a matter of law, the bar owner could sue the musician in that case and get the money for that that lost sales, the time that they if they were able to get another musician, whatever. Those are all things that they could argue that are reasons why the musician should have to pay them, you know, for that. But obviously that never happens because, again, the professionalism of the industry is very low, and we send these text messages making contracts like that, but we don't think of them like that. And so you don't see a whole lot of, you know, if you were to go down to the Pinellas County Courthouse and sit in on small claims court, you would see almost every other industry, you know, plumbers, you know, drywall, cabinet, auto repair people, computer repair people, credit card companies collecting a $600 delinquent credit card bill. Huh. But you would not see a musician... Or a bar. You really just don't see it. People don't litigate.
I think when I first got my talent agent license, you helped me with all the process, and you called me up one day and you said, John, I've done some research and I forgot what the number was, so don't quote me, but you're like, over the last like 15 years in the state of Florida, only one talent agent has actually been, and I don't even think he was tried. I think he was...
Okay, well, I remember the conversation you were referencing, and okay, so the talent agents, just for the listeners who may not know, there is a statute that requires people that act as talent agents to get a license. Obviously, you know this because you're a licensed talent agent, right, John? So... but that statute also sets out a lot of specific rules that apply to license holders. And if you're a licensed talent agent, there are certain legal expectations of you. And it also, you know, as artists or people that are represented by talent agents, you are given a lot of rights, and you're also given an avenue to complain about talent agents that don't do business the right way or the legal way. You can go to the Florida Department of Business Professional Regulation, the FDBPR, and you can file a complaint. And thousands and thousands of complaints get filed every year against talent agents. It's a very common thing for the department to investigate a talent agent that's not doing business properly. But there are very few published opinions from courts or the FDBPR as an administrative body levying a fine or taking away somebody's license. It's not to say that they don't take away people's license all the time, but when you're trying to look at the statute, the talent agent statute, and figure out what it means, there's not a whole lot of guidance beyond the statute itself, because there's not a whole lot of written material about it.
We spoke about this, and you had mentioned, you know, we were reviewing my contracts or something, and you had mentioned that, hey, look, this is a really gray area. on
right.
certain things.
Yeah.
So this is the what I really want to ask, and maybe you can help me see it from your point of view, because not only are you a lawyer, but you're also a artist and a musician. And why do you think that over the years, certain artists have been screwed over, put in bad positions, done wrong? Why do you think that they won't come forward? Is it, I don't want to come forward because I'm a, I don't want to be that whistleblower? Is it the same thing with political scandals? Because I, and the reason I ask this, and I want everyone to understand, and especially you, is that I get, I have a lot of conversations with a lot of different musicians. The majority of them are cover musicians right now. And over the years, I've heard a lot of stories of how they've been done really wrong. And not just in the state of Florida. At one point, we were, Carrie and I had venues in 9 states. So it was not, you know, most of the stories I heard were out of state as well, that they were getting done wrong. And which I know that, you know, you don't know each state's laws, and I don't expect you to. But why do you think musicians don't come forward and don't say anything?
My first thought, or my, I guess, hypothesis to answer that would be the power dynamic between the musicians and the agents.
There's my dogs, folks.
Or the people that would that they would file a complaint against, right? So, because I think what, and this, like, I don't want to name any names about people that, you know.
Oh, no, we don't have to speak names.
But obviously, I've had some situations where people were not doing business with me the way that I prefer to do business. And I chose to handle that by not doing business with them anymore, rather than filing a complaint and trying to litigate it. And, you know, the part of the problem, you know, just is that the professionalism being so low, the fact that contracts are, they don't include a lot of terms where that would be included in virtually every other contract, like attorney's fees. This is the biggest one. Most contracts, if it's a contract that's, you know, had some thought put into it, you'll put in there that if you have to go to court over it and you win, the other person has to pay for your attorney, right? And so it makes it a lot more easy to go to court, because if I'm an attorney and you bring me that contract and it says, oh, I can get the other guy to pay for my fees, I'm a lot more likely to want to take your case, because I know I can get paid. All I have to do is win. And, you know, otherwise I'm going to ask for the money up front. And so a lot of people, they don't have the resources to litigate these things. And then they don't have the knowledge that, because like for the, as far as the talent agent stuff goes, that's what the statute's there for. That's what the FDBPR is there for. So you don't have to hire an attorney. You just call the FDBPR and they take care of the rest. You know, I mean, you still have to be involved because you'll have to be a witness. You'll have to testify. But you can get restitution at money, whatever money you lost for the botched deal. You could get that back. You would just have to see the process through by talking to your government officials and getting them to enforce the law.
Now, and that's I know we've had this conversation before, and that's one of the things that I just I find so odd, is not the fact, like, no matter what business you're in, you're always going to find shady people. It's going to happen.
Right.
And I don't find it odd that musicians aren't going to contact their Florida state agency. I understand that they're not, some of them aren't just going to go out of there. But what I find funny is when they get done wrong, and then they go back to work with them for next week.
Right.
So
yeah, well, obviously, you know, because I obviously as a lawyer, I get calls from people, and they're telling me what's going on and what should they do and that kind of stuff. And you know, I'm almost always going to say, do not book another gig with that venue, right? Because that's pretty obvious to me. It seems that if they're willing to jerk you around and, oh, one night they're not going to pay you, or then, or they're going to pay you a month late or whatever, you know. But a lot of musicians, they need the money and they don't want to lose the gig, and they're willing to put up with, you know, and tolerate a certain level of punishment.
What blows my mind is there's so much work in town.
Yeah.
You know,
and my perspective too is that when you cut those people off, when you cut out the cancers, they go away, because they can't, if people aren't allowed to do business like that because all the talent refuses to work with them, then they go away because they can't do music anymore because they can't get the good talent.
No, they can't get the good talent. But you'd be amazed that what goes on. I mean, I know you know the majority of it. It's just it strikes me as odd because, like, I guess I hold myself up to a high pedestal, and I want to make sure that I'm completely legit. Completely upfront with my artist, that I tell them, "Hey, this is what I can do and what I can't do. You know, I'm not able to book yet the amphitheater right now because I don't have the connections." So,
right.
You know, and I always try to be.
If people knew, if they, first of all, that when you're thinking about contracts and making the deal from the beginning, and you get you cover all those bases, you're less likely to have a situation on the back end that's going to lead to a problem. So when everything's clear, when the expectations are clear, you know, if, for just to use an example, if I'm a band and you're the venue and you're booking me and you're expecting me to bring people, that needs to be discussed. I mean, I can't bring people or promote or I can't deliver on something that I have no idea that was expected of me to deliver.
Communication is the key.
And so if people fully communicate, and I think maybe you shared, I know you're big on Ari's take, right? You like the blog. And I think you shared with me an article that he had written and actually saved it, where he listed just like a very simple list of terms that he just copies and pastes into emails that he sends out to venues when he books, that just basically it's like a fill in the blank for the venue person. Like, here, fill in the blank on this. And it's like, how much is our bar tab? When is load in?
It's phenomenal because you might get rushed into a conversation or booking a gig, and you might be on your way to your day job, and you take the phone call or you take in the text message, and you just want to solidify the gig, right. And you're not thinking. But it's really important that you think about these details beforehand. I wanted to say one thing about Ari's take. Is that he just wrote a new book, and he published a new book, and it's called How to Make It in the New Business Industry or World, and it is absolutely phenomenal. Yeah. I'm halfway through. It's very, very resourceful, so anyone at home who's really interested on the everything from how to hire a engineer to how to book a gig, everything and anything in between. It's really good, but
yeah, he's got a lot of little nuggets. He's got some stuff, and I'm
really trying to push the education on this podcast, and
yeah,
so that we all can get better. So back to the contracts. And this has come up a lot lately. Pay to play. All right.
Ouch.
Right? So here's the deal. And this is, multiple people have called me on this. And I can't advise anyone. I'm not a lawyer. And I really don't know about this. And I think we briefly spoke about it. So I take a gig at a local pub. And I go in there and I book the gig with the manager. and the manager takes a cut for me to play there. So
the manager of the restaurant.
The manager of the bar is in control of doing the schedule for the bar. So a couple months prior, I booked a gig with him. And then he's also taking a cut, a $25 cut or a $30 cut, whatever the band's getting, whatever the 15% of whatever the band's getting paid.
Where's the cut come from? Does he take it from the band? Door?
From the band.
So he's just whatever the payment of the that was supposed to go to the band.
Yeah, so the manager works for the venue. He's not a subcontractor.
Right.
He actually works for the venue. He booked you 3-4 months prior. You come in the gig. Your full band plays for $700. Yeah. And at the end of the night, he asks for his 15% of that $700.
Well, let me ask you, let me answer your question with a question. If you think that this would be all right, I'm just going to kind of switch the...
Sorry.
Good night.
Good night.
I'm going to bed.
Good night.
Just switch a couple facts around and see if it still feels, if it still has that icky feeling to you, right? What if the agreement... what if they just took that money out from the beginning, like the manager, 15% went to the sound guy, or 15% went to the house to pay the wait staff, or 15% went
to pay the busboys
or something like that.
As long as something was communicated like that. So for example, when there are many venues where you get all of the, you set your door price. You're selling tickets, but you know up front that you've got to pay the sound guy $200 and you got to pay the door guy $100.
Well, yeah, okay.
And they tell you up front.
It's a really easy question to answer if the contract doesn't say anything about it, or if there was never any conversation beforehand that, oh, by the way, 15% of this goes to the house. I mean, so because the fact that it's a manager who's an employee of the establishment, that means that he's not a talent agent. He's not subject to the talent agent regulations. He is an employee of the venue, and you're being booked by the venue. So if the venue wants to take 15% or 20% and pay the sound guy or the staff or the manager or the guy in the bathroom, it doesn't matter. If it's in the contract and it says that, then you got to pay it, and that's just, you shouldn't have
agreed to the contract. So as long as it's specified.
Yeah, so I mean, the thing is if you have, so that kind of gets to a little bit, I guess, a point to make about contracts, that one clause, there's a type of clause that every lawyer will always put into a contract. It's called an integration clause. And what that means, or what it'll usually say, is something like, this written agreement reflects the full and final agreement between the parties. And what the meaning behind that is that we may have had conversations over the phone discussing this or that term. Maybe I'm supposed to pay the guy in the bathroom 10% as opposed to 5%. I'm like, well, why am I even paying the guy in the bathroom? And you're like, well, he's very important to the ambiance, the rest, whatever, you know. And so but then in the written agreement, it says 20%, and I sign it. And there's a clause in there that says this represents the full and final agreement. Well, that conversation that we had before on the phone is irrelevant because I signed the paper that said 25% to the bathroom guy, and that agreement also specified that this written agreement is it.
Gotcha.
So that's what, you know, something that you'll probably never get in a contract with a bar, unless you have a boilerplate form contract that you just keep in your file, and when you go to a place that you've never played at before, you just hand it to them. This is what I use with all my clients. You can sign it or not, and it has a lot of this boilerplate language in there. that covers you on things like that. So then when the, at the end of the night, when the manager's like, well, I'm the door, we collected $600 from the door, but I'm keeping 15% of it because I made a poster, or I, you know, invited this girl to come and she actually came, you know. Well, it's not relevant because it wasn't in the written contract and we never discussed that. And if he doesn't pay you the money, you just take what he gives you, have him write you a written receipt, and then you take him to court later and you get the rest plus attorney's fees and damages, because that's all in your written agreement too.
Wow.
But people don't think about that kind of stuff. I mean, what I would like to see is as just a basic form of agreement that more artists were just throwing out
there. So and that is where my next question was going after hearing that all that. My next question, and let's skip on the local cover gigs, because you do, for anyone who has not heard Jared before, over the years, Jared does a couple original projects, Between Bluffs and OK, but Jared also plays a lot of cover gigs to help with some income coming in every now and then. And I met Jared at Green Iguana years and years ago, and he played a cover gig, and I'm like, who's this guy? Where'd you come from? And that's how I met Jared. But for cover gigs, and this is something that I think could help the local Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater, the beach, the beach, the pubs, the industry. I really think this could help. Would it help if we sat down with owners, drew up a basic one-page form, put the expectations down there? Because the problem I see, I see it, I'm the middleman. So I see the venue's point of view, and I also see the musician's point of view. Yeah. I see the venue takes a musician and he stuffs him in the corner and puts a big screen down and the game's behind him and that guy's playing behind a big screen. And then the owner comes up and he goes, hey man, when you bring one out, you know, you're just not high energy, and you know, you're thinking, going, dude, you got the hockey game on behind me. I'm just sitting here strumming a guitar. How am I supposed to compete with, you know, 10 games left of the right. season or whatnot? So, but then you also have, you know, the venue's gripe, you know, and the venue's point of view is, hey man, we really want someone to have more energy, and we got the stage set up right, and we got a stage for them, and they took a 45-minute break, and it killed the whole vibe. And so, yeah. I as a middleman, I see both points of view, and there's multiple things. I have lists on both sides from the musicians and from the venues. But do you think, or would it be so? For example, if we had these forms drawn up, and we have both parties sit down and say, hey, let's discuss this. What do you really want out of your music program? And what do you really want out as an artist? What's come to term on these? And they listed the terms. Do you think musicians would be willing to sign those contracts? And do you think venue owners would be willing
to use them?
To use them, because because my theory,
I don't know. I mean, it's a difficult question. And the thing is I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, you're good. Talk.
I can preach about this stuff as a lawyer, but when I take off my lawyer hat and I put my musician hat on, I'm not going around and throwing, you know, contracts at people and throwing the book at people and preaching to people. And, you know, I've got my bar card and my wallet here, but I'm not like putting it on the table at the bar and saying, oh, by the way, you know, I'm a lawyer and you better sign the contract, you know, because there's a certain aspect of negotiation and doing business where you kind of have to feel the vibe of what is appropriate for the situation you're in. And, you know, I've also gotten to a point where I work you know, there's a certain group of people that I work with, and I, you know, like you and a couple other people that I just do business with, people that I'm comfortable with, to a point that I don't feel that it's necessary to memorialize everything into a formal written agreement.
Well, the only reason I was thinking about this is because I think it's really important that we start communicating expectations.
Yeah.
And we sit down, because there's been many a times venue owners contact me and they say, hey man, you know, none of your bands are bringing anyone. And
I think a lot of the musicians always want to put it on the venues. Like they always want to say,
oh, it's both parties. Both parties have their qualms. Vice versa,
yeah. And, but I would, if I was going to say, you know, I don't know that you could necessarily just bring both parties together. I mean, in a utopia, maybe you could, but I think it would probably be easier to put it on the musicians and say, you know, as far as, because you're a talent agent and you work with a lot of musicians, so you can set standards for what you think is appropriate and professional. And that's going to automatically apply to all the musicians that you work with. And you could say, look, when you work with a venue, if you're working with me, we have this contract that we use. And that kind of sets a bar of professionalism that all those musicians are going to start, you know, abiding by if they want to work with you. And the same goes for the musicians. I mean, the musician that goes to the bar and books the gig, And they exaggerate what they can do for them, and they
don't. Oh, I see that all the time.
Those people ruin it for the rest of us. Yes. By setting these unreal expectations and then creating bad relationships.
And the letdown.
And those kinds of things make it more difficult for other people who want to be honest about what kind of service that they're providing because you have to remember is you're taking money from somebody. You need to provide a service to take that money. You don't have to bring 1,000 people to bring value. You can, just the fact that you're there playing music is value, and you can put a number on
it. It is value, yes.
But you need to explain that to what you're providing. If all you're going to provide is a person playing music with a sound system, then be clear about that. That's perfectly fine to tell the bar, I'm not going to promote. You are paying me this much money. If you want me to promote, you need to pay me more.
Yeah.
And negotiate those kinds of things.
And I just wrote a blog about it. It'll be released soon, and it's based on communication. And I really think that both parties could benefit more if we could learn how to communicate better. And actually said that. Like, I talked to a venue owner not too long ago, and he was telling me the exact same thing. Bands aren't bringing no one in. No one's coming in. There's no value to the music program. And I said, well, I've designed a couple templates, and I have a couple blogs, and there's some things that we can go over to help create a better music program, help create a better ambiance. Right. And they don't
have buy-in to that.
They don't want
to be everything to everyone. They want to do a sports bar. They want to do trivia night. They want to do,
yes. No, they want to the UFC. They want to do everything. But right. I think it would really, really start benefiting people. And the market wouldn't be so saturated if you really want to do a music program, do some research on it. Sit down and talk to people in the trenches. Get to know someone. Any of our current clients or any new clients, I'd be more than happy to spend hours talking about what little tweaks they can make. See, because I want them to see. I want them to see the benefits of their music program.
Everybody wins if this music program is successful. The musicians get to play for people. The agents get to book the gigs and make the money.
Everyone's happy.
Communities formed.
And it's everyone happy.
But you got to get the buy-in. I would also put it on to us though. Like you're the one there booking. It's your job to sell your product, and you know, your product is to create an awesome music program to where eventually you're booking 7 nights a week because people are so, this place is so
in tune with the sound
that, you know, there are people coming out every night. But everyone has to understand that people coming out and spending money at the place is what drives this whole business.
Oh, yeah. And that is the point right there, is that I think it's a good place to start for cover musicians or original artists, because at both either one's going to be playing one type of venue that's driven by money. Either local beach bar or, you know, the local music venue that showcases up and coming acts. They're both driven by the dollar.
Right.
And so I think it's important to understand business. So for example, if you're booking a cover gig on a Friday night, the band should not cost more than 5% of your total sales.
Right.
So if it's 5%. So you know,
I booked gigs where, you know, we've gotten 10% on the bar tab before. Is sometimes when you play for bar tab, I think 10% is a pretty standard number. But I think when you get to certain places, maybe, you know, where you're talking about, where these beach bars or places that have a higher volume bar, where you're pulling in, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 plus off of sales from the bar, then you're going to be at a point where, you know, you can afford to pay a flat fee for a band, and there's going to be less pressure to put on the band to bring people in the door. Like, you know, I don't get a lot of pressure to promote or to bring people in the door when I play at the bigger beach bars or the hotels.
Yeah, they're established. They've got a built-in
crowd. It doesn't matter if I post on Facebook and bring an extra 5-10 friends. They're still going to average the same.
They're going to make their
sales. There's only so many seats in the restaurant, and they're going to be full. But you go to another place where they're not going to fill every seat in the house just with the built-in crowd, and the sales are going to be lower. Then you're going to the income's going to have to come from another place. It's either going to have to come from a door fee, or it's going to have to come from a percentage of the bar, and the musician's going to have to be willing to take a little bit less money guaranteed, and they're going to have to take a little bit more on their shoulders as far as promotion if they want to make any money, because there's not the built-in crowd, and the bar owner's going to have an expectation that, hey, like, you're taking a portion of my sales and you need to deliver something. So I think, you know, part of it is really, I think I would put more on the musician than anybody else in the relationship, because they're the ones that are supposed to have the knowledge of how this is supposed to work. And they have to kind of take that responsibility
and explain it. And I do people. Agree with you, but I also agree that venues should be willing to, venue owners who are serious about doing music, whether it's only once a week or bi-weekly or whatever the deal is, they should be willing to sit down and
they gotta be realistic too about what they're gonna get.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a Friday night and you're in an area with 30 other bars,
yeah,
and you've got a cover musician, you can't expect them to bring 50 people out. It's not going to happen. Yeah. Especially, one thing I tell bar owners all the time is that cover musicians, the majority of them are hardworking professional guys who are playing 4 to 5 nights a week. Right. So if they're playing in Wesley Chapel on Thursday night, the fans, that musician's fans from St. Pete Beach aren't driving to Wesley Chapel to see him.
No.
They're just going to wait for the following week until he's down at Postcard Inn or, you know, or whatever. And that's
people don't drive across the bay.
That's the thing I try to express to a lot of new venue owners is that there's very few cover bands that have followings. Now, there are, I mean, the bigger cover bands have great followings, but on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, someone playing a Friday night in Tarpon, and then a Saturday night in Palm Harbor, and Sunday brunch in Ozona. By Sunday brunch, if his fans came out to either Friday or Saturday night, they're probably not going to come out on Sunday.
Right.
And he's not going to have that that musician's not going to have a huge draw. And this does not mean the musician is bad. And this is a preconceived notion that I think managers get in their head is that an artist will show up and that artist steps in and he starts playing a couple songs. And the manager's looking around and there's five people sitting in the bar and they're going, oh man, I'm paying this guy $200 and I just don't see the benefit. And then that manager gets a notion that it's an artist and that he's not good. And he establishes this from guests not being there. But in reality, it's not the fault that the artist is not good. It's that the decision has already been set by the manager. And I've managed for years and I still bartend and somewhat manage and I see this happen in the industry all the time is that the staff creates their own ambiance. I've walked into bars and been so excited, gung-ho to see a band.
Yeah.
And I walk in, and you just walk in, you're like, oh, shit, man, why am I here?
This is weird.
God, these servers don't want to be here. The bartenders hate this place.
Yeah.
The manager's giving me the evil eye. It's like, what the fuck are we doing here, you know? And then I feel for the band because the band is picking up their energy.
Right.
And it's a trickle down effect, and it all boils down to ambiance. So when I was at the Green Iguana, we did music twice a day, 7 days a week. And I would get stuck every Sunday night on that inside bar. And 90% of the time, I had some awesome kick-ass bands playing. And then every now and then, I would get some really bad. And at first, I had this mindset of, oh, put my head down, I'll be Eeyore the rest of the night and be bored and just get drunk again, you know? And then I realized, okay, everyone moved outside because they don't want to be inside because this night's not good. What can I do to change the mindset? And so I started clapping and I started interacting with the band.
Yeah.
And I started making them feel comfortable. And once they felt comfortable, people started coming back into the bar, listening to the band.
Right.
I broke the ice. So there's a lot of factors that go into...
Take a little bit of weight off the band. You know, I felt... You feel a lot of pressure when you're a musician.
Oh, I can only imagine.
And you're going into that room... And everybody's got a, you know, mean mug on their face, and they're looking at you like you're weird. And you know, you've got to break the ice and create a relationship. And there's a lot of pressure for that. So I think when people are willing to kind of work with you on that and break down that barrier, it makes it so much easier. But I think with the venues, you know, a lot of venues, again, it's like we said before, they want to be everything to everyone instead of trying to think beforehand of what kind of vibe or atmosphere they're trying to create for their patrons. And I think it's more about that than about, you know, because then you know whether or not the musician is good. It's not whether or not the musician is good or bad. It's whether or not they're good for you and your place and what you're trying, what kind of atmosphere you're trying to create.
Well, and I think that boils down to knowing your market, knowing and whether you're a musician or venue. So if you're a musician and you're pushing an original project, know your fan base.
Right.
What do your fans want? What are they like? You know, and it's the same thing. Like if you want to be the happening top 40s dance cover music venue, you know, create that. Go right. for it, but right. create it. But if you want to do a singer-songwriter night or just jam bands or...
Yeah. Or throw a cover singer guy in the corner while the football game is on.
Yeah,
but... That's fine, too, but don't expect that
yes.
to be, you know, him to bring 50 fans.
Know who you are and know what you are. So here's what I'm thinking. I have a lot of more questions to ask you, and we're well over an hour right now. Why don't we set up a time and do episode 2 and rock some episode 2? Because I got a ton of questions that I didn't even touch on, trademark and a couple more booking questions and contracts. And so we're going to get everyone, we're going to get Jared Simpson back for episode 2, and we're going to make this happen. This is John Samuel signing off, and thank you very much for being on the show, Jared.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us today on episode 8 with Jared Simpson.